by David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
186. This is the prohibition. This is the prohibition to slaughter the sacrifices outside the designated area in the temple. That means there's a place in the temple called the Azara. The Azara is the sanctuary, for lack of a better word to describe it, the sanctuary. There's an obligation to slaughter the sacrifices in the sanctuary, and there's a prohibition to slaughter them outside of the Azara. If a person does slaughter them outside of the Azara, then he incurs the Kares penalty. The Kares penalty is premature death. According to most authorities, means death before 60. God takes care of him, right? The court does not put him to death. That's if he slaughters it outside of the Azara. Now, the idea here is that we are supposed to have a set place to serve Hashem. When a person gets used to having a set place to serve Hashem in the sacrificial service, so then, obviously, it enhances his appreciation of the place and it enhances his service. Yes, sir?
Is anybody made that from
davening in one place? Oh, that's exactly what I'm going to get to. Now, from that we get to the idea of A, davening in one place, B, davening in shul to begin with. Right? The whole idea of davening in shul, davening with a minyan, davening in one place. What's the idea of davening in a shul? If you have a sanctuary which creates a certain environment of holiness, so it's going to raise you, it's going to elevate you in your davening yourself. If you're with a minyan, what's the idea of davening with a minyan? There's a quorum of 10. So first of all, on a spiritual level, it means that there's a certain potency to the prayer when everybody's involved with the prayer. But in very practical terms, what's the idea? Why does it help you when you daven with a minyan as opposed to when you daven by yourself? So what happens when a person davens by himself? You throw on your tefillin, right? Kind of mumble the words. Maybe you think about them, maybe you don't. Rip the tefillin off, right? You do one of these quickie jobs on the davening, right, and you're finished. When you have to go to shul and daven with a minyan, so there's a certain amount of, for lack of a better term, peer pressure. As a result, nobody wants to show themselves to be an unspiritual individual. Everybody wants everybody else to think they're spiritual. So what are you going to do when you're davening in a shul? You're going to close your eyes, and you're going to daven Shema Esrei, and you're going to shake a lot and put on a good show, if for no other reason than everybody else should see that you're very spiritual. You maybe close your eyes a little bit and go like this, right, to show that you have feeling, even though you're not feeling anything. But at least everybody else will think that I have feeling. They'll see that I'm sensitive, right? What's the idea? Who are we trying to bluff? We're not trying to bluff anybody. If we're willing to, if we put on the show, if we go through the motions, going through the motions may generate a certain amount of genuine feeling. If we don't go through the motions, we're not going to get any genuine feeling at all. When you daven at home, you're not going to get any genuine feeling at all if you daven by yourself and you run through it. If you're in a situation where even though you're only going, the whole Judaism works with the, if I put on my tefillin in the morning and I don't feel anything, so why should I put my tefillin on? The answer is that if I don't put the tefillin on, I'm certainly not going to feel anything. If I do feel them, put them on, maybe in spite of myself I'll feel something. But without it, I'm certainly not. That's why we always have the principle that even if a person has no motivation at all, you should do the mitzvah anyway. By doing it without motivation or with the wrong motivation, eventually you'll do it with the proper motivation. If you don't do it at all, you're not going to jump from zero motivation to pure motivation. You've got to go through you got to go up the steps of the ladder and get to the point where you have your, you know, the Vilna Gaon says that when the Talmud makes the following statement: a person should serve God even when he does not have proper motivation. A person's purpose is to serve God. A person should do Torah and mitzvahs. He should study Torah and he should do mitzvahs even if he does not have perfect motivation. Because by doing it without perfect motivation, he'll eventually come to do it with perfect motivation. The Vilna Gaon says on that statement, the Talmud is not making a suggestion. The Talmud is telling you the correct formula to begin serving God. The correct formula is to find yourself with an alternative motivation. That means if you study Torah, you should not study Torah. Your motivation for studying Torah should not be because God told me to study Torah, which is the purest motivation. That shouldn't be your motivation. Why? Because if it is, you'll study Torah for 2 days and it'll stop. If you find an alternative motivation, the alternative motivation will create a situation where you want to continue. If you don't have an alternative motivation, then you're not going to want to continue. You can only maintain this inner motivation for so long. Eventually a human being is going to break. When the human being breaks, then he's going to stop studying Torah altogether. Therefore, a person has to find some type of alternative motivation in order to get himself to study Torah, to do mitzvahs, to give charity, whatever it is that he's involved with, because otherwise he's not going to do it all. You know, in charity, what would you say about somebody who he gives a donation to the shul, and they put up a big plaque that says, Mr. Donated by the Schwartz family, right? Or a person gives charity and they give him, make a dinner, you know, to honor him. What would you say about such a person? What the Gemara says? Gemara says he's a righteous tzaddik. Such a person is a total tzaddik. A man gives, the example of Gemara is, a man gives charity, he says in the merit of this charity, he wants his son to live. His son is sick, he gives charity, in the merit of this charity, his son should live. The Gemara says he's a tzaddik gomer. It's not proper motivation. Proper motivation should be, I'll give charity because God said to give charity. Why do we give charity? We give charity because A, we're hoping for something. B, we're hoping not to end up on the other side, on the receiving end. We'd rather be on the giving end than the receiving end. That's not proper motivation. You know, they said that there was a tzaddik who used to walk the streets. When he would give a poor person charity, he would give him a second time. He'd give him once, and he would give him a second time. Because the first time he felt he was giving it because of his own emotional need to give charity. He thought, oh, as a poor man, I feel sorry for him, I have to give him charity. The second time he would go back, he would give it to him because God said, give charity. So the motivation has to be, ultimately, the motivation has to be perfect, but the only way to get the perfect motivation is by jumping in where the motivation is not perfect, where you have alternative motivation. I told you, any motivation is okay for learning Gemara, for learning Torah, except to make other people feel bad. You can't learn Torah so you can go around showing other people how little they know and make them feel bad. And then I told you the Gemara says better personally, I shouldn't have been born. Right? But if you're using using Torah or any mitzvah is a way of gaining honor, prestige, pleasure, whatever you want to use it for, that's fine. Because the only way you'll ever get to use it is perfect motivation. So that's the idea of davening. That's the idea of davening with a minyan, davening in shul. Now, when you daven in shul, you should have a set place for the same reason. When you go to your makom, what's called the makom kavua. The makom kavua is your permanent seat in shul, which you know that halakhically you have the right to it. If you've davened in a seat 3 times in a row, a seat which is not already occupied by somebody else. If you've davened in a seat 3 times in a row, then you have the right, when you come into shul, to ask somebody to move from that seat if they're taking up your seat. Now you can't, I've seen people walk into shul, you know, they walk in 45 minutes late, and somebody's sitting in their seat, and they're like, you're in my seat, right? Well, you know, it's not your, you know, how long can you claim the seat? Just because you walked in, it's not your property. It means if you're there for davening, you have the right to daven there, because knowing, what's the idea? The idea is that knowing you have a set position, a set place in the shul, that will enhance your davening. That means I could walk into the shul knowing I'm comfortable, that I don't have to go running around now looking for where am I going to put my sitter down. I know I could walk into the shul, have a place to put my sitter down, and start davening. Yeah.
And that's someone's place for Shacharis and someone else doesn't have any, like Maariv, and you don't have any Maariv in his place. I mean, what is there?
No, so that's his permanent seat for Maariv. That's his permanent seat. Maariv is your permanent seat for Shacharis. I see sometimes people walk into shul, somebody's sitting in their seat, so they walk up to the guy. The guy walks in, somebody's sitting in the seat, walk up to him, and he goes, just stares. Finally, the guy looks at me and goes, oh, am I in your seat? Mm-hmm. Well, either yes or no. Either you want to ask him to leave or you don't want to ask him to leave. But if the problem, make him feel bad, then don't ask him to leave. Right? You have a right to ask him to leave. You have a right to ask him, you mind sitting over
you
here?
You just as much obligation to get out of someone's seat if you feel good.
Correct. I remember, you're willing to ask people to get out of your seat, yet when somebody asks you to get out of their seat, you're insulted. Right? You can't have it both ways.
And I dive in the base midrash, but I usually miss the minyan, but I go in there about 8:30, you know, in the morning every morning. And it is pretty much empty. And in the last 2 mornings, I guess there's been somebody that's a seat that he learns, but at this time, the whole place is empty. And just like you said, I'm in the middle of Shemona Esrei, I can sense him standing there, like almost, and he puts his coffee down, and he's standing there, and then finally, yeah, he moves and sits to another seat,
He shouldn't be doing that.
And he shouldn't.
He shouldn't be doing that. If it's not his seat for davening, it's your seat for davening.
Yeah.
And it's his seat for learning, Right? He has no right to move you out. There's no such thing as permanency.
Well, he's never said anything, but I mean...
You don't, sometimes you don't have to.
Yeah, I'm saying, the whole place is empty at that time anyway.
You could, right, it's enough, it's, you know, you the best thing would be, if it's bothering you, to just tell him nicely. And people always get all huffy.
Bring me coffee.
That's a guy. If you're bringing coffee, you can bring me a cup. I'll tell you. Okay. 127. Sorry. 187. Isn't that amazing? Another amazing thing about the Torah, it goes from 187 to 127. Oh, yes, if I transcends nature. The okay. 187 is the mitzvah to cover the blood. A very interesting mitzvah, and I've never seen this done. I've never seen this done personally, but it is a mitzvah that applies even today. And this is the mitzvah that when one slaughters a fowl or a chaya. Now there are two types of animals. You've heard the word behema. There's a behema and there is a chaya. A behema and a chaya. A behema is a domesticated animal for the most part. A cow, a bull, a sheep. Those are all behemas. A chaya is a deer, an antelope, any of the kosher animals which are kind of run wild. You don't see anybody on their farm. You don't see on a farm. You wouldn't expect to see bulls, cows, and deer. Right? This is not something you see. So any of those, I don't know the names. Do you know the names of the other kosher animals besides deer? All the wild, what they're called, venison. They call them venison, right? They're various species. Yeah, venison is what they say, what Yitzhak sent Esau to go get him. Right? But the venison are definitely kosher. But there are different opinions about there aren't different opinions. The Torah spells it out, but we don't necessarily know what specific brand name it is. But the chaya is, it's an animal also. It's not a non-carnivorous animal, but it lives out in the wild as opposed to being domesticated. The halacha is that when you slaughter a deer or you slaughter a bird of any sort, you must cover the blood. Whereas when you slaughter a behema, a cow or a goat or a sheep, there you do not have the obligation to cover the blood. Covering the blood literally means you take dirt or sand, and after you've shechted it and the blood drips out, you have to take sand and literally cover over the blood. It's called the mitzvah of kisui hadam, the mitzvah of covering the blood. Now, the idea is that it's a kind of esoteric idea. The birds and wild animals, you would associate with what? The wilderness, right? Cows are more associated with, they're domesticated birds. And birds and chayas, birds and deers, you associate with the wilderness. What goes on in the wilderness? What did we speak about yesterday? When we speak about pushing the goat off the cliff, the wilderness is always associated with what? Certain forces of evil. Right? There are certain forces of evil. Do you know that the Torah prohibits blood? Why does the Torah prohibit eating blood? You know, according to some of the commentaries, it was used in the ancient world. The pagans used it as a way, it was a rite, in order to contact the demonic spirits. They would immerse themselves in blood. They would eat blood as a way of reaching this perfection of negative spirituality in order to contact the demons. Right? They would eat blood. They would actually use the blood somehow with the vehicle in order to make contact with these demons. So the Torah says, these demons themselves, certain shadim, the demons, this world of a certain dimension of existence which God created, there's a level of demons. You have man, you have angels, and there's a level in between. Right, where they share some characteristics with human beings and some characteristics with the angels. They're a middle level. These demons themselves feed on blood. And which blood would you expect them to feed on? The blood that is associated with where they hang out. Where do they hang out? They hang out in the wilderness. So the blood that they're most closely associated with is the blood of the birds and the blood of the wild animals. Therefore, the Torah says when you slaughter birds, wild animals, cover over that blood to take away any accessibility of the demons to that blood, and anybody who might want to contact the demons will not have this temptation. The Torah talks about it all the time. You know, the Gemara says that a person is not allowed in the times of the Talmud where there was an outhouse or any type of dirty area out in the fields. Right? It was prohibited for a person to wander out there alone. because he could be harmed by the demons. The Gemara says that if we would be able to see, if God would give us the ability to see, we would see that we're surrounded by them. We're surrounded. There are thousands of them around us. There are thousands of them in the room at this very moment. They're called mazigen, right? They call it, you know, if you ever feel kind of crowded in the room, right? That they could be, that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says there are mazikim everywhere. Animals have a greater a sensor to be able to detect them than human beings do. Right?
What's the shade?
I'm sorry?
Shade.
These are shade. They're demons. Demons. Right? So they're all...
They're not allowed to be on the public road or something?
Right, they're off on. They're off, the stories are stories. They're off on. They're off on the side. They're out. They're associated with places of wilderness and desolation, which is what we spoke about yesterday. And they're also associated with blood. And therefore, this mitzvah comes right after that mitzvah. And this is the mitzvah to cover over the blood of those animals. Okay, so that there should be no association with the demonic spirit. I told you, it's pretty bizarre. According to the commentaries, you're probably not interested in demons, right?
Yeah.
The blood of the animal. The blood of the animal. No, you don't really.
It's on the floor. They're walking around in it.
Who is? Not in the base of English. We're not talking about the base of English. We're talking about an individual. I take a chicken, and I decide they have some chicken. Chef the feed it. Yeah. We're not talking about the base of English. This is at any time, that you chef the chicken. Not to say chickens were not brought in the base of English.
So
in a kosher abattoir where they chef chicken, every time they chef the chicken, they have to cover the blood.
Correct. Chicken's off. What was brought in again
when the Kohen nicked it with his thumb? Those were pigeons. Pigeon turtle doves, right? And he nicked it with the thumb. Chickens are not brought in the Bishop. Okay. Now, the Gemara says that man is made up of four, you know the four basic building blocks of man are? We just spoke about this. Fire,
earth,
wind, fire, and water, right? The demons, these shadim, these mazikin, are made up of. You got a problem, not the other. I don't know any more about this than I'm about to tell you, right? They are made up of two of those basic building blocks. They are made up of the non-physical ones. They're made up of wind, whatever wind is, ruach and esh. They're made up of wind and fire, right? Angels are not made up of any of them. Man is made up of all four of them. This level of existence is made up of two of them, Ruach and Esh. That's their level of existence. God created them, and they have a certain function to fulfill. Okay? Next mitzvah is 188. This is the prohibition to commit sexual immorality or have contact with any type of forbidden relationship. Probably not interested in that. Let's go on. The idea is that according to the Chumash, you're not allowed to make any physical contact with members of the opposite sex. According to some, this includes any type of physical contact. According to others, by Torah law, it is speaking specifically about sexual relations as opposed to other physical contact. But whether it is or isn't is totally immaterial, because even if it is by Torah law prohibited to have sexual relations, it's certainly rabbinical law to engage in any type of physical contact outside of the sanctity of marriage. That's first of all. Second of all, there's a prohibition by Torah law across the board by Torah law to have contact with a woman who has menstruated, and a woman, even if she's not your wife, even if she's not married to somebody else, the assumption is that she is a nida. The assumption is that she is in a state of being a nida, and therefore it would be prohibited to have any contact with her. Now,
can kids have contact with her? Children?
Her own children, yes. Her own children, yes. And a man can have contact with his mother, daughter, wife, sister, type of
no,
thing.
No, John said during nida.
Oh, no, during nida, no. You mean when she's a nida? Yes, they're allowed to have contact with her. The children can have contact with her. The only one who can't is her husband. Actually, you end up in an ironic situation that where a man could get on a bus, and let's say the bus gets very crowded, and he's going to be pushed into a woman, and his wife is on one side of him, and there's another woman is on the other side of him, he's better off, if he's going to be pushed, allowing himself, if his wife is Anita, he's better off allowing himself to be pushed into the other woman. Right? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was actually asked if a man is allowed, is forbidden for a man to ride the subway in the morning in New York, right? Because it's inevitable that you're going to be touching women on the subway. You're going to be banging because it's very crowded in the morning. I mean, I personally think it should be prohibited because of danger to life, but that's my own opinion. But Rav Moshe Feinstein, they asked me, is it prohibited for a man to ride the subway? So he says it's not prohibited because he's not on the subway thinking about how many women he can touch. He's just getting on the subway to go to work, and it's purely incidental if he happens to bang into someone. If it's a guy who's looking forward to the ride on the subway every morning and can't wait for his ride on the subway, then you're right, then for him it's prohibited. But in general, to be pushed incidentally into a woman, that's obviously not prohibited. You got to be able to ride to work every morning. Now, what they did prohibit, and this was instituted by King David. Do you know the story of Amnon and Tamar? King David had several wives. Do you know how many he had? He had 18. 18. No, that was his son Shlomo. Shlomo had 1,000 wives. Shlomo had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Right? King David, a concubine is a woman who is your wife, but there's no marriage contract.
Why did he make it a round number?
I'm sorry?
Why did he make it a round number, 1,000? I mean,
what does the name Shlomo mean? The name comes from Shalem. Comes from completion, right? Isn't it ironic that the king Shlomo is the one who builds the temple? Right? No irony that his name. There's no irony to the fact that his name is Shlomo, and he's the one who brings the completion of the Jewish people. He brings the temple. So part of his mission in life was this idea of marrying all these women. What do you think, that King Shlomo? Do you think that if Shlomo was a low life, that God would have appointed him as one? God says to King David, in the not, God says openly, you're not going to build the temple, your son is going to build the temple, your son Shlomo is going to build the temple. Do you think that if Shlomo was on such a low spiritual level, God would appoint him to be the one to build the temple? He's obviously on a very high spiritual level. He's trying to accomplish something in his marrying all these women. He's trying to accomplish some form of completion for the Jewish people. He's trying to bring the world to its ultimate destiny. Right? So there's no accident about the numbers that he marries or the fact that he married so many women. David HaMelech had 18 wives. Now, one of his sons was named Amnon. This was a son from one wife. He had a daughter named Tamar. She was a daughter from a different wife. Now, Amnon had a crush on Tamar, right? And he didn't know what to do. So he was advised by a very wicked man that he should pretend to be sick. He should play sick, right? And then he should ask his father, David HaMelech, to send him this Tamar, who he was very fond of, to send him Tamar, and she'll come in and take care of him while he's sick. So he calls, he gets into bed, and he gets sick, and he says to his father, please send Tamar in to make me some dinner. So his father sends Tamar, he's living off by himself, she sends Tamar over, and she comes over to Amnon's house, and she walks into the house, and he says, okay, I want everybody to leave, right? And she prepares him a meal, and he's lying in bed, and he says to her, okay, now I want you to bring me the meal. The Nach says she brings him the meal, and he assaults her, and he rapes her, right? What brought it about? What brought it about was the fact that they were alone with no one else around. At that point, they made a decree that it is prohibited by rabbinic decree, stemming back to the time of King David. It is prohibited for a man to be alone with a woman. Which woman? Any woman other than his wife. That is, I'm sorry?
That one was his sister, though, in that case, wasn't it?
It was his stepsister. It was his half-sister, right? It is prohibited for a man to be alone with a woman because the temptation is so great that it's a barrier that will hopefully stop all sorts of shenanigans. Now, the halacha is, nowadays you walk into there are some very practical halachas here. You are not allowed to be alone with a young lady behind a locked door at any time. You are never allowed to be alone with a woman behind a locked door at any time.
Elevator?
Right? An elevator, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, is not a problem because chances are it's a short ride. Right? I mean, if you're a real low life, so then you're not interested in Rav Moshe Feinstein saying, you're not, yeah, right, you're not interested in, you'll get the elevator jammed, right? You know, it's not a problem, right? There are people who will avoid it. There are people who will avoid being alone in an elevator with women. There are people who will be alone and avoid in general, even if it's technically not prohibited. They'll avoid being secluded with a woman. Let's say,
in the office.
in the office is a very big problem. In an office is a very big problem. At a doctor, a woman goes to see a doctor, and the doctor locks the door. It's a very big problem. The door is not allowed to be locked. The halacha is that to go into a home where the woman is home alone, if she's a married woman, you're allowed to go in, and she could even close the door as long as her husband is in town. Right? Because that means, not lock the door, close the door. What's the idea? The idea is that because her husband could possibly come home any minute, he could come home and he could walk in unannounced, so she is certainly going to be on her best behavior and there will be no shenanigans.
What about him?
Who?
The other guy.
Well, the other guy also doesn't want to be caught by her husband. If her husband's in town, he doesn't feel like getting shot. Yeah, well, her husband doesn't fit. No, that's not a problem. We're not worried that, you know, that type of thing. But the idea is that you have to avoid a secluded situation. When a person goes out on a shit off, you should know. You have to be very careful when you're meeting a young lady or you're out on a date. Right? Not that anybody here does, but I assume you're all in shidduchim. But if you meet a young lady under any circumstances, you have to be careful not to be in a secluded alley. Or a lonely street, or on a dark beach, all by yourself. It doesn't have to be a dark beach. It could be a light beach, and you're all by yourself on some lonely beach. Right? You have to be very careful. You're not allowed to do that because then you're secluded. Like, some of it is relative. There's even a question about driving in the car. So if you're at night, some say as long as the window is down or the door is open or something, right? Right. But in general, not the door is open. I mean, you don't have to walk. What are you guys doing? Well, we're very from. A cop stops, he gives you a ticket. You know, for driving with all four doors open, right? it's a strange religion you got. Yeah, well, what can I do for Torah? Right. Obviously, you don't have to do that. But it is a problem to leave somebody who is of questionable character. It's a problem to leave him alone at any time with a woman. Right. Sometimes a problem on a bus. You get out of a bus. You get off the bus, and the only one who's left on the bus is some young girl and the bus driver. Right. And it's the last bus at midnight. Right, so there's some that say it's better not to get off the bus at that point because you're leaving them alone. Right, so that's a problem. Now, the Gemara also says that for this reason, a young man who is not married should not be a teacher, should not teach children. A young man who is single should not teach children. Why? It's interesting, the perspective, the difference between the Torah.
What about married
man? A married man is not a problem. The problem is that a single man, and a single man should not teach children. Should not. Why? Because brings the children to school, their mothers, right? So what happens is you may get, slowly but surely, the mothers, when they come to talk about their child or bring their child, they can end up in a situation where they're alone with the teacher, and the familiarity of the situation, because you get to know them, as you get to know each other, it becomes worse. I just saw Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a responsa that a young lady who is married, and she wants to know how she can do tshuva. She was working in an office, and she and her co-worker were involved in a physical relationship. Now she's married to a guy learning in Kollel, and she wants to know how she could do tshuva for her past misdeeds, right, being in that office. And very often what happens is, in the relationship, because of familiarity, so then it removes certain built-in barriers, the familiarity, and therefore one has to be even more careful where there's familiarity. Right. So that's the halacha of yichud. Included in this, any questions so far? Included in this is the prohibition to make eye signals at women. You're not allowed to make any type of eye signals. Also, because it's
married
a,
or unmarried.
Married or unmarried. Married or unmarried. Because the eye signal is a way of initiating some type of contact. It can easily lead to immorality, right? It means any type of contact. Eye signals, it's performed. What's the question?
What was the general thing you said to begin with? What is this? Just prohibitive?
The prohibition of being involved in immorality.
Oh.
In Gilui Arayos. Excuse me, one second. This is getting more. Okay. Included in this is the prohibition to make eye signals at women. You're not allowed to smell their perfume. Right? All of this is because of the nature of men.
Even to smile at somebody?
You're allowed to smile. smile at somebody, you don't have to, you know, hello, how are you, a woman. You don't have to change. You're allowed to be pleasant, but there is a line that you cross, which is the next one. You're not allowed to joke with women, right? That means. I think this has to be taken with a grain of fire, right? The idea is, you're allowed to be a pleasant person, right? We're talking about getting to the level of frivolity. Frivolity and lightheadedness, why is it that Pirkei Avos, it says, laughter, in Pirkei Avos, ethics, Jewish ethics, it says, laughter and levity leads to immorality. Why is that? Laughter and levity leads to immorality. The idea, it's the perfect word. The idea is that inherently, everyone in the world knows that there is something inherently prohibited about engaging in immorality. Everybody knows that inherently. The guilt associated with it, very often there's a certain feeling of guilt associated with an illicit relationship, and the guilt is a result of taking a certain type of pleasure from the world, which you know you really weren't entitled to at that point. Right? It's only in the sanctity of marriage, where you have engaged in a certain responsibility, you've taken on a certain responsibility to the woman, it's especially from the man's direction, by the way, where the guilt is in the man's direction because he's, to a certain extent, taken advantage without having any type of responsibility. That guilt, inherently, a person knows inside that this relationship is not proper. Laughter and levity, exactly what you said, it creates a carefree attitude where I'm able to shield myself from facing up to the reality of the fact that I really shouldn't be doing this. What stops me from facing the seriousness of the crime? Quickly make a couple of jokes, laugh about it. It creates the environment where nobody's going to be serious, right? In such an environment, that can lead to immorality.